Tonight we have a great amount to cover, so let me make sure I've got everything ready here where I can have the Bible ready for us. We have a great amount to cover tonight, and so we're going to try to talk fast. The passage we look at tonight continues in some way the theme that we looked at last week, how God can use negative circumstances. But it's an expansion of the theme, and we're looking at how God can use everything. Now, in church work, we often, if we're not careful, think of church as the kingdom of God being the church. And we think, now, if you work in church, you're doing the work of the kingdom. And sometimes we even talk about church work and then secular work. But for the Christian, there is no such thing as a secular job. Everything we do is for the glory of God. Whether you're working in a factory, whether you're working in a hospital, whether you're a homemaker, whatever you are, for the Christian, that's all used for the glory of God. Every kind of work is a calling. Doesn't mean it's all exciting, but it means that God uses all of our work to accomplish His purpose. The passage we look at tonight reminds us that even God uses politicians. Now, it's also important to realize God uses politicians that we may not agree with. God uses politicians who may not be good people. Because tonight we're going to look at a series of political leaders that God used, and when you understand that even the Christians, when they were being used, probably disagreed with the policies these politicians were putting into place. And even though it disagreed with the politician, with the, what the Christians would have wanted, God had a plan and used what they were doing, even though the Christians didn't like it. Now, there's a great truth here. You've heard me say it before and probably say it again tonight. If you and I were in charge of the universe, we would not put God in charge of personnel. Look at His track record. He uses kinds of people that we don't like. And that's amazing. But now, it doesn't say that character doesn't matter. No, character matters. But we just have to have confidence that God is ultimately in control, and the things which we can do something about, we're to do something about. But if it's out of our control, we have to trust God's character. Now, who, what, when, and where in this passage tonight? Who? Every book in the Bible is about God. It's revealing who God is regarding the nature and character of God. The passage we have tonight, we know the when pretty closely. It's 60 AD, and we can be very close in that because we know from extra-biblical sources when these guys were rulers in Judea and in Caesarea and in that part of the world. There are historical records that show what year they took over. The where, the map will show you again, and we'll spend a little bit of time on the map. Remember, Jerusalem is the religious capital of that area. That's where the Sanhedrin, that's where the religious folks make their decision. Caesarea, that's the political capital. And remember that the Jews in this area was an occupied territory. They were being occupied by the Roman government. They didn't like the Roman government. Because the Roman government had a view of religion that was totally pragmatic, with one exception. The Roman government said you can worship any god you want as long as one of the gods you worship is the Caesar. And remember, Jews and Christians said, no, there's only one God that you serve. We're not going to call Caesar God. We're not going to call anyone. So as a result, there was a significant political military force from Rome in this portion of the world. But as I said, Rome was very pragmatic. They didn't try to alienate and make the Jews angry. Instead, they tried to work with them at all possible because they didn't want difficulty. They didn't want a rebellion because that consumed financial resources. That also required more military help. So they tried to get along the best they can, and they would appoint leaders. And we'll see some of the leaders they appointed had some Jewish connections. Caesarea is the political capital. That's where the governor, and for those who were responsible, we'll have two or three sections tonight that we'll be talking about, that most of this happened at Caesarea, a little bit of happens in Jerusalem. Now, there, in order to begin with chapter 25, let me quickly review, and we do not do much review in Key Bible Study, but really what's happened leading up to this, because it's really part of a big unit. In Acts chapter 21, Paul is returning from his third missionary journey. He is speaking in the temple. There is a conflict and difficulty breaks out, and he is arrested. He is arrested, and then he's going to be tried before the Sanhedrin. Remember, he's in the religious capital, not the political capital. He is taken before the Sanhedrin on religious charges. But the Sanhedrin cannot offer the death penalty. They cannot really imprison him for any length of time. So when he stands before the Sanhedrin, they want to find a political charge because they wanted to be able to turn him over to the Roman authorities and say, you execute him. He's broken a Roman law, and the one they were accusing him of, they're accusing him of really being traitor and very similar to the charges against Jesus, but are also saying he desecrated the temple. And which desecrating the temple was a religious charge, but if you did anything real serious in there, there could be a political charge. So he's before the Sanhedrin. Acts chapter 23. The political leaders are told and warned that the Jews, the religious leaders, are going to try to kill him. The court system isn't working on their behalf, and so they're going to try to take things into their own hands and kill him. So in Acts chapter 23, the political leader, who is Felix, arranges for a large number of soldiers and horsemen to slip Paul out in the night and then on that map go back up to Caesarea and put him in jail there where they think he will be safe. Acts chapter 24. The governor in that area, Felix, it's really in chapter 24, the one who sent him there is really not Felix, it's one of his representatives, but he sends him to Felix, Acts chapter 24 that we looked at last week for the hearing. Now at the hearing, what he does, he listens to the case and he says, you know, you Jews haven't convinced me that he's done anything legally wrong. But the pressure is being put on by the religious authorities, find him guilty of something. Felix says, can't do it, but we'll keep him in jail and let me consider it for a while. Keeps him in jail for 2 years. Now, Felix is smooth. He tries to develop a compromise. He's going to keep him in jail, but he's going to give him freedom. And he can go in and out of the jail. He can visit friends, and so he's able to do some teaching in the area of Caesarea. Now, in Acts chapter 24, after Felix's term is finished, he moves on to another place to be governor, and there is a new governor appointed. And that governor is Festus. And usually the first thing that a new governor would do would look at all of the prisoners and he would release those who were guilty of nonviolent charges. because you built the goodwill of people. Because, and he knew that there was not any serious charge against Paul, but he doesn't. He doesn't let the apostle go. Festus is this new leader. Now, a couple of things about Festus. Festus is liked better by the Jews than Felix is. And he is, we don't know very much about him, but we know that the Jews were encouraged when he came in. Now, being encouraged, remember, they were encouraged probably thinking, he's going to side with us, he's going to agree with us, and finally something's going to be done against Paul. Now, Acts chapter 25, verse 1. 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Now, when you say go up, you know, he said went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. In our mind, it's map going down. Why did he go? He's the new leader of the area. He knows that even though Caesarea is the political capital, you better go where the religious head honchos are. So he makes an appearance. He goes down on a goodwill building tour and down to Jerusalem. And when he goes there, verse 2 says, where the chief priests and Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. It's been 2 years. They're still mad about Paul. He's seen as a threat. And apparently the first thing they do when Festus comes to Jerusalem, they say, hey, are you going to make a decision about Paul? And they urgently requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. They were saying, why can't you just send him back to us? Yeah, we agree it's a religious problem. You just send him back and we'll take care of it. But notice what Luke says. He says, as he writes Acts, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. They want to get rid of him, and they really don't want him to come back to Jerusalem. They're going to ambush him. Verse 4, Festus answered, Paul's being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me and press charges against the man there if he has done anything wrong. Festus says, I'm not budging. Yeah, we'll go ahead with the trial, but we're going to do it in Caesarea. Now, Acts chapter 25, verses 6 through 12, says, after spending 8 or 10 days with them, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. He goes back to Caesarea. First thing he does is says, okay, you've been asking for a trial. We're going to have the trial. When Paul appeared, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many serious charges against them, which they could not prove. They didn't have proof. Then Paul made his defense, I have done nothing wrong against the law of the Jews, or against the temple, or against Caesar. Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on these charges? Now, Festus is a little weak right now. He's saying, hey, Paul, if it's okay with you, why don't we all go down and have the trial back in Jerusalem? And here's a key phrase. Paul answered, I am now standing before Caesar's court where I ought to be tried. If I have done anything wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well, I have not done anything wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. In other words, if I'm guilty, I accept the consequences. I have not done anything to the seat. But if charges against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. That's the important phrase. He says, I am a Roman citizen. You can't move me back and allow me to have just a religious trial. I am a Roman citizen, and as a result, Caesar must hear my case. After Festus conferred with his council, he declared, you have appealed to Caesar. to Caesar you will go. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. Agrippa is the leader of another area in the general region. Agrippa, he's an unusual character. Agrippa grew up almost as a special wonder child, in the sense he was born to the right families, and it was assumed that he was going to climb the ladder in the Roman world, and he also had some Jewish blood in him. So he appeared to be almost a perfect match for that portion of the world. But Agrippa, he's got his problems. But we'll talk more about that in a moment. But the thing to remember about Agrippa, he is considered one of the more knowledgeable leaders regarding the Jewish religion. That's his expertise. The Romans, when they have an issue they don't understand about the Jews, they ask Agrippa, because he's got this Jewish background. But now it really gets interesting. A few days later, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. Now here's where it gets interesting and sordid. Bernice is not his wife. It's his sister. And it is assumed by historians that there was an incestuous relationship between he and his sister. Historians indicate that there were all kinds of rumors about him. His sister, Bernice, it's really his half-sister. She has more Jewish blood than he does. And Bernice, she marries another guy to give the impression that there's nothing incestuous between her and her brother. But she continues to live with her brother, even though she's married to another guy. And another time she has an affair to try to convince the public that, hey, there's nothing wrong with what's happening between me and my half-brother. Well, not only that, later in her life, she has a real affair with the Roman emperor. Now, she's the kind of woman that would never get elected WMU director in a Baptist church. I mean, that just wouldn't happen. You know, she is, you know, that's one of the things that isn't going to happen. Now, they come together, and why do they come to Caesarea? They come to congratulate Festus, the new leader, because that's what you do when a new person assumes responsibility. They're coming by to congratulate him. Since they were spending many days there, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. He said, "There is a man here whom Felix left as a prisoner. When I went to Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him and asked that he be condemned. I told them that it is not the Roman custom to hand over any man before he has faced his accusers and has an opportunity to defend himself against the charges." He goes ahead and says, "When they came here with me, I did not delay the case." And he goes ahead and then, you know, justifies what he's done. And he said, "Instead, they have some points of dispute with him about their religion." He said, "I'm really thinking this is a religious issue, and it's about a dead man named Jesus who Paul claimed was alive." Now, Festus doesn't understand the Christian faith, and he's wise enough to know he doesn't. He said, "If I understand the whole thing, it's about a dead man that somebody claims is alive. I was at a loss how to investigate such matters, so I asked if he could be willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial there. When Paul made his appeal to be held over for the emperor's decision, I ordered him held until I could send him to Caesar." Then Agrippa said to Festus, "I would like to hear this man myself." He replied, "Tomorrow you will hear him." He's saying, "Agrippa, I need some help with this." And he's asking for advice, and Agrippa's response is surprising. He does not give him advice. He says, "I want to hear and interact with him myself." Now, Festus realized he had probably the most knowledgeable person in that portion of the world that was in the Roman government to talk about this religious issue. Now in Acts 25, 22, 20 through 7, Festus explains to Agrippa again why he's asking his advice. We're not going to go through the entire passage on this one, but he says, I'm insecure. I don't want to make a mistake. But verse 23, and I think we've got time to chase this little rabbit here, says, then King Agrippa, then the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room with the high-ranking officers and the leading men of the city. At the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. Now, when you picture this, generally we think about the dialogue between Paul, Agrippa, and Festus. But there was a much larger audience. There were all of the leaders. There were people in high positions. It may have been, the conversation may have been more for them in God's plan than for Agrippa. And there's an important truth there. There's a preacher, George Buttrick, that wrote a famous sermon called Overhearing the Gospel. And in fact, I think he even wrote a book by that same name. And on one occasion, I read an essay that he wrote that came out of that sermon. And he says, when we Christians share our faith, we're often thinking that the only person that hearing that is the person we're speaking to. But he said, you may be talking to someone about the Christian faith, and they go home and tell their wife about that conversation. They may never accept the truth, but their wife may. And he says, remember, people are always overhearing on the mission field. And those of you who have been on mission trips, you know that when you preach and teach, there'll be people standing around the side listening. And the audience is not just those in front of you. Well, Agrippa never accepts Christ. Festus never accepts Christ. But we don't know about those others. The presentation of the gospel Paul makes, it's evidence, he's not evident that he's not just talking to Agrippa. He wants them all to hear it. He said, verse 26, but I have nothing to write, and well, let's skip on down. Let's go to verse 1 time-wise of chapter 26. Then Agrippa says to Paul, you know, you have permission to speak for yourself. They brought him in. Agrippa's, he's the master of the room, even though it's in Festus's territory. And he says, tell us your story. So Paul motioned with his hand and began his defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all of the accusations of the Jews. Little theme we talked about last week too, a sub-theme. Notice how Paul is always courteous to authority. He says, I count it a privilege to be here. And especially because you are so well acquainted with all of the Jewish customs and controversy. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. That phrase of listen to me patiently is more than Agrippa, I want you to sit still, shut up, and listen. It's more than saying this is going to take a little bit longer, but it's the concept. You need to think this through. This is not something that is going to be a quick emotional appeal. That's so important. Rarely are people pressured into receiving the gospel. It's a process. There are moments, and some of you have heard me share this before, when I first became a Christian, in many ways, it was one of the most disappointing days of my life.
because my father's conversion was very dramatic. My father had many bad habits in his life. At age 32, he becomes a believer. It is an emotional experience. He is trembling as they give the invitation in a church service. And I mean, it is a life-changing moment for him. I became a Christian having grown up with a father. I wasn't born until my father was in his 40s. I'd heard the gospel all my life. And when I finally became a Christian at the request, my mother invited me to invite Christ into my life in a church service, and I went down and went forward, and I wasn't emotional. I didn't feel different because I'd heard my dad say, you know, I was shaking and trembling, and I woke up a new person, and I knelt and prayed and asked Christ into my life, and I didn't feel that much different than I did before. But mine was a process. From the very time I was born, my parents had been teaching me. And so it took me 10 years to get there. I was about 10 years of age. But it was a process. Now, there are some dramatic conversions. But most people, it's over a period of time that you think this through. And Sunday morning, when Haley made her profession of faith, I believe it was in the 11 o'clock service. It was either 8:25 or the 11. It was 8:25 service, I believe, when Haley. And Haley, I mentioned, it's been a long process. Haley is a girl that grew up in this church. She's got good Christian teaching. She came to see me almost a year ago. And she had good questions all the way through. And finally, there was that moment. Now, when Paul says, Agrippa, be patient. It's not the idea, just sit there and be quiet. This is the beginning of a process. And then he says, the Jews all know the way I've lived ever since I was a child, from the beginning of my life in my own country and also in Jerusalem. They have known me for a long time and can testify, if they are willing, that according to the strictest sense of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee. In other words, he says, my accusers, I've lived the same kind of life that they have lived. I've had the same value systems. And verse 6 says, and now it is because of my hope in what God has promised our fathers that I'm on trial today. You may want to circle that verse. That's one of the key verses in understanding. The Bible is one story from beginning to end. The Bible is a story of God making a promise to Abraham. And he said, Abraham, you're going to be my people. I'm going to use you to take and your descendants the message to the entire world. And as God continued to speak through the prophets to the people of the Old Testament, there was always the promise of a Messiah that was coming that would fully redeem. God made a promise to Abraham. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament, not a contradiction of it. It is the same promise that God made to Abraham that is being continued in the life of Jesus. And Paul says, the reason I'm here today is because I believe that hope that was made to Abraham. And I'm still believing it today. And he says, basically, they're accusing me of taking my faith too seriously. Isn't that interesting that often we do that today to people? If Christians get a little bit too enthusiastic on something, we want to say, don't take it quite that seriously. He says, this is the promise our 12 tribes are hoping to see fulfilled as they earnestly serve God day and night. O King, it is because of this hope that the Jews are accusing me. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? That's another key phrase. If you believe the Old Testament, if you believe that God created the heavens and the earth, if you believe that God chose a man, Abraham, not because Abraham was good, but because God was good, if you believe that God led the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, and if you believe that God divided the Red Sea and they walked across on dry land, and if you believe that God provided manna from heaven, if you believe the miracles of the Old Testament, if all of that happened, couldn't God raise His Son from the dead? And remember, one of the things that they were saying was, he is believing in this Jesus who he says that God raised him from the dead. And he, and remember, he's talking to a man who knows the Old Testament. Agrippa was not a believer in the Old Testament, but he understood. He says, why is it incredible? And just a quick aside there, and we bring around, this comes up again later in the passage. Remember, everything begins with your understanding of God. If you believe that God is all-powerful and all-knowing and unlimited, then everything's possible. But if you don't believe that, it's not going to make sense to you. And the Jews gave lip service. They said, we believe everything's possible, except we don't think that Jesus was ever raised from the dead. In some ways, they had limited their God. And sometimes we Christians do the same thing. We're really not believing that God can do anything. There's something, God will not violate His character. We do know that. Verse 9, I too was convinced that I ought to do all that was possible to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. He's saying, now when I first heard about Jesus, I was like them. I didn't believe in Him. And that's just what I did. On the authority of the chief priest, I put many saints in prison, and when they were put to death, I cast my vote against Him. Many times I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished and tried to force them to blaspheme. In my obsession against them, I even went to foreign cities to persecute them. In other words, I was very radical in my Jewish views. And then he says, on one of those journeys, I was going to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. About noon, O king, I was on the road. I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, blazing around me and my companions. We all fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It's hard for you to kick against the goads. Verse 15, then I ask, who are you, Lord? I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting, the Lord replied. He's giving his testimony. Sometimes when we give our testimony, it's more about us than about what God did to us. Notice he doesn't focus on what he felt. He didn't give all of the description. It's a very simple form. And sometimes when we tell our conversion or we've experienced an answered prayer, we talk 99% about us and a little bit about what God did. Notice how he keeps the focus, not on his feelings, not on what he thought. He says, and I ask, you know, who are you? And the answer was, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. Now get up on your feet, get up and stand on your feet. I have appeared to you to appoint you as a servant and as a witness of what you have seen of me, and I will show you. I will rescue from your own people and from the Gentiles. I will rescue from your own people and from the Gentiles. I am sending you to them to open their eyes
and turn them away from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, so that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me." Another important phrase in the story. One of the reasons Jews were despised was a legitimate reason. Now, there were some wrong reasons they were despised. They were despised because they worshiped only one true God. Nothing wrong with that. We would believe in that. They were often despised because they had a higher system of morality. But they were also despised because they had a sense of arrogance about them. We have our own God, and our God's going to save us. Fooey on the rest of you. And you know the Old Testament custom that they had, wasn't taught, but it was custom. But you know, one of the things that you would thank God that you were not created a Gentile, not created a woman, and not created a dog, and there was that. The Jewish males were really arrogant because this Old Testament belief is just for us. They misunderstood God's promise from the very beginning. What did God say to Abraham? "You, through you, you will bless the whole world." And over the period of time, they heard it, "And to you, you will receive a blessing." Great word of warning for the church, too. God wants the church to be a means of taking the gospel to all people. And he says, from the very beginning, Paul says, "I knew I was to take the gospel to the Gentiles, to all people, so that they could be forgiven." And then he said, "And that's why the Jews seized me in the temple courts and tried to kill me." Now, that's another reason that we sometimes neglect in describing the persecution when Paul came back from his third missionary trip. Remember where he'd been on those missionary trips? He'd been talking to Gentiles. There was that resentment. He's letting other folks in on the secret. And first, they were saying, "We don't even believe all this secret about Jesus," but he's out there interacting with people that really, this message about God, they shouldn't be hearing it anyway, because they had this very narrow view of God. He says, "And that's one of the reasons Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. But I have had God's help to this very day. So I stand here and testify to small and great alike. I am saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen, that the Christ would suffer, and as the first to rise from the dead, would proclaim light to his own people and to Gentiles." This is another great verse. Said several key verses in this. This is a verse that will help you when you read the Old Testament prophets. When we read the book of Daniel, when we read Ezekiel, when we read the prophets, we often get hung up on what they're trying to tell us about the future. You can read the book of Daniel and try to figure out what nations are being referred to, and you can read, the book of Ezekiel and try to figure out all the things about the dry bones. Notice what he says the prophets are about. He said, "I'm saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen. Christ would suffer, as the first to rise from the dead, would proclaim light to his own people and to the Gentiles." When you're reading the prophets, remember they're about Jesus. They're not to help us to know what the signs of the end time will be. They're about Jesus. The prophets are revealing that a Messiah will come. He will be a suffering servant. Yes, there are some things that give us insight regarding the end times. But you can know all the details about the end times, and if you do not focus on the Jesus who was going to be resurrected from the grave, you've missed the point of the prophets. And also the prophets were saying,
And it's not just about the Jews. It's so that all people will have the opportunity to hear. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. "You're out of your mind, Paul. Your great learning is driving you insane." In other words, you're too smart for your own good. Notice who says you're insane. Not Agrippa. Festus. Because he didn't believe, he didn't know and didn't believe about this all-knowing God who had been revealed in the book of Genesis and through the Old Testament. And if you don't believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing God, resurrection sounds crazy. Conversion sounds crazy. Describing a light that comes, strikes you down from the heavens, I've never seen that. It sounds crazy. And so Festus says, man, this just doesn't make sense at all. Remember, the gospel is not unreasonable if you believe on an all-powerful, all-knowing, creator God. And as, as our world sometimes bows at the shrine of science, there really shouldn't be conflict between science and the world, but it's more science rejecting the Christian teaching than it is teaching Christian teachers rejecting science. What happens is that our world wants to leave out the story of an all-knowing, all-powerful God. And if you can eliminate the belief in any kind of God, then the only thing that matters is that which you can see, that which you can touch. But if you believe that an all-knowing, all-powerful God created all that we see and all that we can touch and all we can feel, we as Christians can believe in that spiritual dimension of humanity, and as a result, we can use the sciences in order to accomplish God's purpose. But if you leave out the foundation of an all-knowing, all-creative God, then everything is, the spiritual is impossible. Verse 25, "I'm not insane, most excellent Festus. What I'm saying is true and reasonable." Notice verse 26. He looks at Festus and says, "You don't understand." Now the king, Agrippa, he was called King Agrippa, really King Agrippa II, he is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I'm convinced that none of this escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. Now, what he means not done in a corner, he's saying, this is not the first time Agrippa's heard this story. And it wasn't. It's the first time he's heard probably Paul's conversion. But being acquainted with the Jewish rules and teaching in the Old Testament, probably heard the Christian story. He says, this is not brand new to him. Verse 27, "King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do." Notice there is a direct appeal. King Agrippa, I've told this. Do you believe this? In our generation, we have done some things as Christians that are healthy, but sometimes we've got unhealthy with one in particular. We really believe in relationship evangelism, and I do. And I'm not minimizing. There was a time you used to go door to door and knock on people, and you know, if you died tonight, do you know who would you go to heaven? And that's difficult to do because, especially today, if you don't know people, they don't know whether to believe you. You know, they don't know if you're selling something or selling insurance. You know, if you died tonight, who'd get your stuff? You know, that is the question. And so as a result, that doesn't work much, door-to-door evangelism. But a relationship evangelism does, where we get to know and we get to talk to people and over a long period of time. But there's a downside. Sometimes we think, if we just hang around with each other enough, these non-Christians are going to catch on and want to believe. No, sometime you have to say to people, you know, we've been friends for 3 years. I've shared, told you about my faith. Have you ever considered believing in the true and living God as revealed in Jesus Christ? Do you understand what I'm talking about? Would you like to pursue this a little further? But we just assume that someday the light bulb's going to go on, they're going to come to church the following Sunday, and everything's going to be just right. No, it takes that one-on-one conversation. And one of the things that, you know, Billy Graham used to say, the most important part of every telecast that he had was not his sermon. It was at the end of the telecast, when they would film those crusades, you would get a close-up of Billy Graham, and he would say, "And I invite you to know Jesus Christ." And he would say it with that gracious southern accent, and it was as if he was talking directly to them. It was needed. We must notice Paul does that with Agrippa. Do you believe this? Even if the answer is no, you're better off than never having asked it. Paul, and then Agrippa says to him, "Do you think in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?" If you're like most of us, you grew up hearing almost, you almost persuadest me to be a Christian. You've sung the song, "Almost Persuaded," you know, and if you grew up in revivals like I did, man, it was always good for a few tears, "Almost Persuaded." But that's really not the best translation of it. The best translation is, "Do you think you've really persuaded me to be a Christian? You've told me to be patient, and now you're already getting to the punchline." Paul replied, "Short time or long, I pray God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains." He's talking to Agrippa. There's a whole lot of people listening. And rather than say, "How dare you not believe this stuff? You've just heard my story. Of course what I'm telling you is true." He doesn't explode in anger, and he says, "Agrippa, I'm praying not only for you. I'm praying for all these other religious people here. I want them to have this same standing with God that I have, and I hope they never have to go to prison for it." He says, "The one thing I hope you never have is the chains. Verse 30, "The king arose, and with him the governor and Bernice and those sitting with him." Then verse 30 says, "And Agrippa's," let me jump ahead to verse 31. "They left the room while talking with one another. They said, 'The man is not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment.' Agrippa said to Festus, 'This man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar.'" That's a partially true statement. That last one that he says, he basically says, "Yeah, go ahead and send him to Caesar." Yes, Paul sealed his own fate, but that was a good fate. But they could have overruled it sometime during this. But the point of all of this, one portion we skipped a little bit, was Festus at one time asked Paul, "Are you sure you don't want to go back to Jerusalem and let them try it there?" Paul made a decision that, "No, I want to go to Rome." More than likely, Paul's fan club, meaning those disciples around him, were hoping that Agrippa and Festus would say, "Let him go free." But they didn't. Paul understood, but there's no evidence that those around him, if they would have let Paul go free, if the Christians would have gotten what they wanted, Paul would have never gone to Rome. If he had never gone to Rome, he would have not been at the center of the Roman Empire. He would not have written some of the New Testament letters that we had if that had been skipped. And how did God make it happen? God worked through Felix, and his wife Drusilla, who I failed to mention, was also a sister, a half-sister to Bernice. God worked through Festus and Agrippa and Bernice. Man, they were a crooked lot. Yet somehow, God used them to accomplish his purpose. Now, that doesn't say that we bless we bless crookedness in politics and that we, no, we work for righteousness and we work for justice. But we're never to panic. If God could use those folks then, He can use the folks that you may not enjoy today. Back to the line, if God were in charge, if we were in charge of the world, we wouldn't ask God to be in charge of personnel. It's about an all-knowing, all-powerful God whose kingdom will not fail. Let's pray. Father, help us never to grow weary of doing right. Help us to work for that which is right and honorable in every day. But also help us never to quit. Never to despair, even when it appears to us that evil is winning. For we know that when all is said and done, you will be victor. Sin will be punished. And because of our faith in your Son, Jesus the Christ, we will have eternal life for now and forever. In Jesus' name, amen.